This is The Financial Coconut, Singapore's first personal finance podcast network. And I'm Timothy Mazier, editor-in-chief of Blockhead. Join me and the crew on our weekly Friday segment as we filter out the noise in the crypto space and keep you updated on the ideas that actually matter. This is Blockcast.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back to Blockcast. I'm your host, Reggie, aka your chief financial coconut.
Hello, hello. And I'm Mark, founder and CEO of Blockhead.
And this is Timothy Mazier, managing editor at Blockhead. And this week, we have a special guest on the show. Yeah, Marcus Thielen.
Yeah, I'm the head of research at Metricsport, the digital asset management platform. And, you know, I have written a book recently and happy to talk about it.
No, and we're in the same space. Oh, so yeah, it's great, great. But yeah, Marcus, you want to tell us a little bit more about yourself, you know, other than where you work, you know, just give us a little more juice for audience to get to know you a bit better. I'm sure people know you, but for everyone else that don't.
Yeah, I think actually a lot of people know me because I publish almost daily on LinkedIn. And, you know, the other day I got like 40,000 views on a post. And then, you know, before like 30,000 and 20,000. So a lot of people, you know, seem to read everything. And it just happened that, you know, I've been in TradFi for, you know, for a long time, let's say, you know, 15 years. It's a long time, you know, for some people. And but I've mostly been on the hedge fund side. So managing money, I used to run my own hedge fund.
So you're on the buy side?
In Hong Kong, yeah, buy okay. side. I used to work for Millennium, the, you know, the large hedge fund and everything. And after my hedge fund, I moved basically to, you know, more into crypto. You know, crypto has been around, you know, for a while, always like next to me. But, you know, because Hong Kong was such a dominant, I guess, crypto market for, you know, the last decade. But after, you know, when I closed my hedge fund, I moved to a firm where I was the CIO. And the firm was, you know, very exposed in crypto mining, crypto VC and digital asset management. And I was a CIO there. And then I moved to Metricsport last year.
Nice, nice. Yeah. Why do you shift to crypto?
Well, I mean,
is TradFi dying?
No, I mean, actually, it's a good point because I wanted something a little bit more exciting. And, you know, I remember like it was January 2013, like the guy next to me at work, he, you know, he bought some Bitcoin on Gox. You know, it took like a week to get sort of like the convo. It was on credit card. You know, the credit card company called him. It was just kind of like a, you know, like a strange process. And when I started then the hedge fund 2015, you know, one of my analysts, he was trying to set up some arbitrage system, you know, with crypto. And I thought, okay, we can get it going. And I mean, because there was always an interest to do something more in fintech, but what can it be? And I think at one point crypto just became, you know, really big that made sense. And it was part of another of the institutional portfolio that was managing. And so 10% of the assets were in crypto and they set up, you know, account for me at Coinbase and everything. But I wanted to do this like full time because it was like so much stuff going on. And it seems like, you know, a lot more exciting than looking at the monthly inflation data and central bank meetings and, you know, and yeah. So simple as that.
Yeah. Hey, Tim, it's the same as you. You're sick and tired of TradFi. You were covering it.
That's true.
You know,
that's
it's the true. Same circle, same bunch of people, you know, drinking with the same crew, you know, asking for information.
Yeah.
Sick and tired of it.
So our first story of the day is none other than a short interview with the author of Crypto Titans, Marcus Thielen, who's sitting here with us in the studio. Right. Crypto Titans was just published last month in May. It provides an overview of the cryptocurrency industry and its evolution, takes you on a journey through its early days till the present. Marcus, what inspired you to write this book and what do you hope readers will take away from it?
Yeah, so I think the key thing, no matter which event I go to, like a private event, you know, be it like some children's birthday party or some school event or, you know,
why are you talking about work at a children's birthday party?
No, but I'm just, because wherever you go, people are interested in crypto, right? As soon as I, you know, people ask, you know, what do you do professionally? And you say, well, I'm in crypto. no matter where the people are from, and again, it can be the school teacher, it can be, I don't know, some lawyer, it can be like some random person, they're always interested to talk about crypto and to learn more.
So now it's just buy the book.
No, but yeah, you know, yes, it's, you know, that's really the short answer, right? Because if you read the book over a weekend, mm-hmm. right, lock yourself up, read the book over a weekend, I think it just all suddenly starts to make sense to you, right? You don't need to pick up a book, you know, what is blockchain? How does the Terra hashes work and everything? I think this book really tells you how the industry started, who were the main players, how the four crypto bull markets evolved, you know, how regulation has impacted it. And I think that's, you know, answers like a lot of questions already for a lot of people. And that's kind of like how I kind of like started to put stuff together, because a lot of those questions were always like very similar. You know, everybody wants to talk about Binance or FTX and, you know, where did the money, you know, what did they do and everything. And, you know, I just really tried to look at the evidence and write a heavily researched, but a relatively neutral book. So it's not about my opinion. It's really trying to give you all the facts. And I think this is why I got like a lot of endorsements from some of those high people that are also in the book that, well, yeah, I didn't really like too much what you wrote about me, but yeah, it's sort of all true, right? That's what you get a lot, right? So because I think, you know, again, you wanted to write like a factual book for people like to understand it. And I think there are like 631 references in the book. So it's really not about, you know, somebody, you know, going off course and just chit-chatting. Mm. It's really, this is what happened. This is how it has evolved. This is when stablecoin suddenly became big. And this is the event that put Binance in business, basically, right? And it answers those questions. And I think a lot of people didn't really know this. And, you know, I mean, long story short, you know, Yevgeny from Vintamut, you know, he started in crypto in 2017. You know, he read the book, you know, endorsed it before it was published and everything. And he's like, I had no idea what happened before. And it was good to just put it all together, yeah. right? And I think that's what the book really answers.
I think that actually, like your last point about, because for a lot of people, especially people who are new to space, right? This I would say, perception out there that, you know, like blockchain, crypto, et cetera, it's this very newfangled thing. But in reality, it's got like, you know, a full 10 plus years of history. That's where I think there's a lot of value there. So the question I have, or rather like, you know, what was interesting to me when you mentioned earlier on about how Ray, I think before the podcast started, we talked about, it's a quote from Ray Dalio about how, you know, you can't fight nature, right? Like, do you see like, you know, in terms of the historical trends, you know, with crypto, right? So it's starting from the Mt. Gox days. And then you have, I think you mentioned in your books, the 3-year cycle before someone else comes to play and eventually the regulators come. Is this like does history repeat itself? Like, is this a pattern that, you know, like we can see in other innovative industries as well, do you think?
Yeah, I think one of the main conclusions, no matter who you are, no matter what your view about crypto is you're going to realize this is not going to go away, right? So if you are Gary Gensler and reading it and, you know, a bit more harshful against crypto, I think you really, what you take away is that this is getting bigger and bigger, and it's just like water. It will just go to the least resistance area. And I think when we look at all these four bull markets, you know, there was one in 2011, 13, 17, and 21. They were all different. They had all different players and they moved a little bit in different jurisdictions. And I think you just realize that this industry actually has become already like extremely big. So estimates are there are 420 million people that have cryptocurrency holdings. Not everybody needs to be a full-time crypto trader, but people have those holdings. And this is, you know, all aggregated data. But again, I think it goes back to the point that I realized whenever I go to an event, be it personal, private or whatever, when people realize that I'm involved in crypto professionally, everybody suddenly wants to talk about it. And you know, some people, a shipping expert from Norway, want to talk suddenly about Cardano and what you think about Solana, and others, of course, you know, the housewives want to talk about Bitcoin and so on. So it's, you know, like everybody has an interest, right?
Housewives
so, yeah.
have started, right? They have started, oh. right? They're all at Bitcoin now.
Well, yeah, I mean,
that's why you say housewives want to talk about Bitcoin.
That's fascinating. I mean, I think that, you know, we would have a similar experience as well. And just different levels of sophistication yeah. and different yeah. entry points, you know, like, you know, some people are turned on by the, I guess, the technological part of it.
Turned on.
Right? Right.
Yeah. You said turned on.
I mean, yeah. turned on. Like, is, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I do have a good day when I see my stuff in green, like,
yeah,
so
yeah,
I could
turn on. That's a lot of turn, yes, right? Yes.
But yeah, that kind of like, it feels familiar as well. I think that's always a sign that, I don't know, man, the cars are going to start collapsing soon, or it's, you know, the fact that mass adoption is on the horizon.
So what is your educated guess for the next few evolution of this space? Like, what's going to happen in your view? Because we study history to help us hypothesize the future, right, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, for example, like the first bull market was driven by Bitcoin as like a new payment system, you know, and it then just evolved, of course, until the fourth bull market that we saw in 20 and 21 was more about building an alternative financial system.
Not because people were bored at home?
I think that's one factor. And I mentioned about this in the book as well, right? And give you examples because also, I mean, we can talk about more details in it, but, you know, Dogecoin actually peaked out with the Saturday Night Live performance of Elon Musk.
Oh, yes.
But at $88 billion, so it's like a meaningful number, right? Mm-hmm. But it's also interesting because, again, I tried to look at all these influencing factors, what was really driving it, and, you know, the price impact that some of these people had, right? And some of these tweets and comments and how other people actually took advantage of it, right? And really changed their trading strategy. You know, Alameda comes to mind, which, you know, potentially started more as an arbitrage firm and then suddenly like, oh, let's just, you know, trade meme coins and go all in and do some other things, of course, right? But I think, you know, the outlook, to answer your question, you know, where we're going with this is technology itself, and no matter what technology it is, it has been so far all about cutting out the middleman. You know, all these, you know, property guru sites you're looking at, it's, you know, taking out the real estate agent and making this a little bit more smoother experience. And I think this is also what is maybe in play for crypto, really taking out the middleman of, you know, the large middle and back office of financial operations or other entities. And I think that's where we're going. It just takes like a little bit longer. And I would argue it probably also needs to have a little bit lower cost to really make it a frictionless experience, right? I mean, you know, we're sitting here recording this podcast. I mean, 10 years ago, you know, you try to like stream like a movie or anything, it costs like a fortune and everything, right? And what was the difference? You know, Netflix wasn't really that big yet, right? It just became big. Mm. But the difference was really that suddenly the streaming became like almost free, right? This is like minuscule cost, right? I mean, now you're seeing people, you know, on the MRT watching some YouTube video and you think like, how much might this cost, right? But it's actually free, right? I mean, the bill doesn't really go up with those things. And I think that's for crypto needs as well, that the costs need to come a lot lower for Ethereum, for example, or, you know, other projects. And then it becomes frictionless to do all these transactions. And I think that may be the big game changer. And there will be probably a new upgrade on Ethereum end of this year, and that maybe is a step in that direction.
Okay, fair, interesting. Anyway, I'm just saying, Property Guru is failing at that job.
Really?
They're failing at a job. They have given up their pursuit because the last mile of transaction, they're failing, right? Because if you think about Property Guru as an aggregator, right, the goal is to help make sure you transact on the platform, right? And then people just post, you transact, but it has become an advertising platform.
Right, like no one's actually transacting.
Yeah,
right?
No one's transacting. So I don't know what's going on. Is it because these are big ticket transactions, so it's very hard or whatever, but they're failing at it.
Of a lot of friction in their process.
Yeah, a lot of friction. So they're failing
at it. We're just talking about friction actually, but I think this was in regards to the Ledger issue.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, at least at a very retail level, when you look at it, I think that unless we find an easier way to kind of like, you know, store our... you know, our bag, right? It's going to be quite difficult.
Is it still a big concern, storing the bag?
It's not. It's just that, like, you know, for example, depending on who you talk to, we go all the way down to the housewives, right? They're not going to get a cold wallet. You know, this is not going to happen.
Not yet, right? Maybe not yet. What does Marcus think? Yeah.
Or maybe they're the first ones who get the cold wallet. Right?
Maybe I'm just
because
being
biased. Because they have more time to, you know, to look into it, right? You know, I think there was an assumption that TradFi has to kind of adjust and become more like crypto or like DeFi over time. But it seems a little bit the other way around. And we having, of course, a lot of big institutional players in TradFi that are, you know, building behind the scenes a lot of the crypto offering. And the difference really is that in TradFi, everything has been broken down into different silos versus in crypto, everything seems to be one company can do everything. We have, of course, you know, FTX was your exchange, you know, your matching engine. It was your
custody,
liquidity provider and everything. And in TradFi, it's all like separated.
Yep.
And I think this is because of regulation, this is also coming for the crypto market. And then basically you don't have, you know, all your assets on the exchange. You know, there was another comment from Binance earlier this week that they're working around this, that maybe the traders don't have to have all their assets on Binance. They can have it like in a separate account.
It feels like Binance is taking a step back or so, you know, a little bit. Like, they feels like they've got a giant kind of like, because like people are going for them.
Yeah,
you
know? Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's a slightly different topic, but I think...
I'm sorry, segue again, but
yeah, we can stay there. No, but yeah. Because it's all really related, yeah. Right? And there's no coincidence. For example, I think last year, July, Binance started to have an aggressive zero fee BTC trading fee strategy and trying to really gain market share. And this is when market share went from 50 to 70%, really. And of course, it put a lot of strain on other exchanges. But magically, just a few days before, sort of like a lawsuit or complaint was launched against them in the US, they stopped this. And I think we have seen more and more over the last few weeks and months that they have taken a step back. And they're letting other people a little bit, you know, shine in the spotlight. And I think Binance is quite happy that their market share is going down, that they're not so much in the light right
in
now.
In the light, right?
Yeah. There was just news yesterday that they're letting go quite a sizable number of employees. Yeah.
Yeah, 20%.
Yeah.
No, I think it's strategic on their part because, like, you know, I think just building for what Marcus was saying, you know, like how moving from essentially like a one company kind of takes care of everything into something that's more in line with mm-hmm. traditional finance, which I guess then the other part here is about regulation. Like, you know, I think one of the points you made in your book was about how the idea that regulation would lead to like new crypto titans, right? Maybe you could elaborate a bit more on like that. I think that part's quite interesting.
Yeah, I think in crypto, a lot of people kind of look at this, you know, the Bitcoin mining cycle, which happens every 4 years as this mysterious, you know, signal that there's going to be a bull market.
Mysterious signal.
No, but it's
just a mystic going.
Yeah, no, it's just, you know, people kind of really explain, yes, and miners need to have more money and therefore Bitcoin prices need to go up to compensate. You know, but kind of like who drives it. And I think the one thing, for example, one of the things I discovered in the, you know, by writing this book and then looking at the data and looking really when were those big turning points, right? Because you can do this, you know, with price action if suddenly the price ramps up. But what really happens, right? It was not suddenly there was, you know, oh, the mining cycle is happening. There was something else was happening. And we had this, for example, in early 2013, when new, I guess, regulation was passed in the US that made it a lot more costly for crypto firms to operate. The on-ramp firms had suddenly, you know, get more licenses. And while the license might have cost only like 50 to 100K, which was, of course, back then a lot of money. Now it's not a lot of money, but it took, you know, a lot of strain in terms of, you know, in-house lawyers. It took them like a year or two to get it. And that was kind of like a turning point when actually the industry moved a little bit away from the US and move towards Asia, because at the same time, also in 2013, in May 2013, to be specific, CCTV, the China state TV channel, a lot of people just don't know this or don't remember this, was actually showing a 30-minute documentary and really telling the, you know, the Chinese viewers that Bitcoin is a new form of money, right? And that was kind of like an interesting turning point. And then later in that year, we have also seen some other supportive evidence. You know, Baidu was suddenly accepting Bitcoin for some online payment services. And then Bitcoin prices just within like, you know, a month or two went up 8 times. And, you know, a lot of people kind of don't know this, but I think there were a lot of these events, you know, where the regulation changed actually the structure of the industry. And then we had something similar happening. Of course, then China became a little bit more restrictive than the following year. But at the same time, Hong Kong in 2014 were like, well, you know, Bitcoin is a commodity and therefore it doesn't need to be regulated. And then kind of, you know, the key law firm says like, well, this is a golden opportunity for everybody in Hong Kong. And again, you're just putting it these events together and it just suddenly makes sense how actually the crypto industry works.
Nice.
Did you know that?
I mean, I definitely didn't know about this CCTV. I mean, definitely like these events, when you kind of like put them all together, it kind of makes sense.
Well, there was another CCTV broadcast last week, right? another pivotal moment for Bitcoin. You're aware of that, Marcus?
Yeah, of course. It's a little bit far-fetched, right? Okay. Because again, it was not necessarily the big bull market story of 2013. There were other factors in place. And again, it's good to kind of remind ourselves what were these events, because then you can easily put them together, right? If you suddenly hear CZ tweeting about, well, CCTV had like a bullish story about the Hong Kong opening of crypto and everything. And then, well, you could have sat there and said like, oh, let me buy some Bitcoin right away. Or you look at the book and say like, let me read these 4 pages that talk a little bit about it. And you realize, well, it wasn't really the big story, right? It's almost like a reference guide too. And, you know, would have like saved you a lot of money because we had, you know, 1,000 points lower now since last week. But again, it was like other factors, you know, Baidu accepting Bitcoin. Mm. But nevertheless, it is a little bit kind of these bread crumbles that I've tried to kind of like identify in the book. And I think we're seeing more and more events and evidence, and we're hearing more and more news out of Hong Kong, you know, / China. And, you know, one of the things I discovered, you know, some people, of course, we all know, you know, Justin Sun.
His Royal Highness.
His Royal Highness, not anymore, right? And everything. But they also, you know, also put down, you know, some interesting stories like about him and everything, and also his timing. And I think that's why he is actually a person that really needs to be watched, right? And of course, he's a very hype person, and it's like his personality and everything, or what he projects. But I think in the book, it also, you know, uncovers his timing for a lot of those events. And the timing is really quite important, right? I mean, if you just go back like recently, you know, there was news in early September that he bought the Hubei stake. You know, he was a mysterious buyer, paid like apparently $1 billion and everything. And, you know, headquartered in Hong Kong to some extent, right? And maybe not legally, but, you know, it's kind of cultural a little bit, the headquarters there. And then when you think about it, what happened kind of like 3 weeks later, right? Actually less than 3 weeks. Suddenly Bloomberg was running a story that Hong Kong will be opening up to crypto, right? And he was like, oh, this guy just like 2 weeks ago or something. You know, yeah, this 2 weeks ago he bought it. I mean, did he know this, right? And they were like,
I'm quite sure.
And they were like, again, right? This is why, and I don't want to give up too much of the book, right? But you know,
buy the book, right?
Because it's also interesting. He did an ICO in 2017, and one day before his ICO closed, China banned ICOs. Yeah,
that timing is actually pretty impeccable.
And they're like and there are like a few other cases like this, right? And I'm just saying, you know, to a lot of people, again, you know, a lot of people, wherever you go in different events, functions, crypto seems like random. They want to talk about this and then jump to this. There's actually a method to the madness, right? There's, you know, I mean, I think this is what I really took away, right? There's like clues and signs. Some people have been in the industry for a while. You know, they're steering it. They're informed. They're working closely with the regulator, or they have the news beforehand. Because you don't buy an exchange and then suddenly like 2 weeks later, it's just Hong Kong opening up and it's really like, you know, your footprint in the market, and suddenly you were like really big, right? So
I mean, he's been very savvy, right?
So is this a point where we start the conspiracy theories? No, about Justin Sun?
No, but this is the point. It's not a conspiracy,
no,
right?
As in the conspiracy is not what has happened, right? But like the theories as to how he comes to know about this information.
And he's been a very savvy player within the space.
I mean, probably like links to regulators, that probably not much of a...
This is where you can go downstairs in your church. And you can talk about it with a red blanket or something, right?
One of my questions I wanted to ask you was, being a crypto historian and the way you had put together like a whole history of the space, I mean, it's super interesting because this is an industry that has been built on lore and narratives and pockets of information that are kept within closed circles, I guess. And piecing it together, basically it's a crypto industry's version of, what's that website, knowyourmeme.com, right? We get the history of something that's only existed, you know, in terms of conversations and online forums and things like that. So I mean, what interesting stories can you tell us from the early days that might be forgotten already? Or
just,
you know,
give one. Don't give away the book, right? Just give one.
I mean, you know, to me, like, for example, 2013 is, of course, like a key year, right? This was like, you know, we saw like a 5,400% increase in the price of Bitcoin, which is, of course, you know, the strongest bull market by far. And, you know, it's kind of important for me because I kind of got to know this back then, again, in January 2013. And then you just kind of like followed. But then it's kind of seemed like all bizarre why people were buying it. You know, there was also in the European debt crisis. So it was really also driven by Cyprus when the price went from something like $13 to like $250. And then it came down when there was kind of like some agreement. But also in Q1 2013, suddenly you had especially people in China coming up with some super fast Bitcoin mining machines. And again, I discovered like some interesting stuff, you know, about my boss, you know, he just invested like 1,000 Bitcoins and a year later he made like 500x return, you know, like those kind of like, you know, unimaginable numbers. But it's also really interesting, you know, the people who kind of developed those machines and how efficient they were, right? Because suddenly they just controlled the market, right? Because you got like some really smart, I guess, like tech savvy guys, you know, sitting in New Jersey in the US and and and, you know, connecting like three PCs and mining like a few Bitcoin here and there. And, you know, these, you know, people in China, he's like, oh, if this works on with three PCs, why don't we just build something with like 100,000 PCs and then build like, you know, factories and everything. And then these machines became so powerful, and people who produced those machines, they basically were selling them at a 1 month recoup your investment rate, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And the Bitcoin price was suddenly like ramping up, and people were making their money back within like 3 days. You know, I mean, imagine you're buying this like mining machine for like, I don't know, $1,000, and you start on Sunday, and by Wednesday, you got the $1,000 back. And then the rest is just kind of like free upside. And this is how the industry became like so crazy, and the people were like involved, and, you know, how many Bitcoins they mined and everything. And I think that was kind of also really like very interesting. And of course, you know, the book, of course, also looks, you know, very heavily the last kind of like 3-4 years, right? It's a crucial part. You know, a lot more, let's say, Stanford, MIT people have entered the space, you know, some good, some bad, of course. And a lot of stuff has evolved, and history sounds like a little bit like so boring, right? But I mean, because we have all lived it, you know, it's maybe more interesting, right? It's, I mean, if you pick up a Second World War history book, it might be like a little bit boring, but here, you know, you have been around, and a lot of stuff you don't know. And it's, I mean, you can read it over a weekend, but I think you're going to learn so much. And, you know, I have like people like sending me like, oh, look, I took all these notes from your book, and, you know, it's kind of interesting. But again, it's just, you know, I'm not kind of like just talking around a lot. It's really just a lot of facts, and you read it, and I think it's interesting. But
okay, so for our readers, where can they find the book? I've heard it's sold out at several bookstores in the city.
Well, I think it's in, you know, in the major local bookstores. I think you have it. I think the, you know, the publisher is filling it up, or the distributor is filling it up. But Amazon reviews has been like very good so far, so I'm pleased, and yeah, it's going well. So.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So yeah, okay, so this is story two that we are rolling with, right? So it's about the US debt ceiling, and of course how it relates to the crypto market, right? So simply put, on the 28th of May, the US lawmakers have released a bill, like a draft of a bill allowing the government to increase the debt ceiling, okay, and which is, if you don't yet know, an imposed limit on the amount of debt the Treasury Department can incur. In other words, the amount of money they can owe, right? So this is based upon negotiation between Joe Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. If you don't know them, it's fine. You just need to know that they're from different parties. So they're not friends, lah, technically, right? So under the proposed bill, there will be a 2-year suspension on debt ceiling, which means more money can be borrowed, allowing the US government to continue to essentially settle its debt and just kick this down, right? And last night, the House has voted on the debt ceiling bill, days before the US projected to run out of money on this to pay its bills, right? And it has passed by a vote of 241 to 187. There are 52 Democrats that went over to support this bill alongside with the Republicans, and interestingly, there are 29 Republicans that vote against the measure, of course, alongside the Democrats. So, and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, which is a Democrat, said that the Senate will do everything we can to hold on to the bill quickly. Yeah, so what is your take? In other words, long story short, it has been sorted, right? Like, money is going to continue to flow for additional 2 more years or something like that.
Yeah, but I think the way to look about it is, you know, the US economy is also growing, right? So if you set up some limit 10 years ago and suddenly the economy has like doubled during this time, maybe you can also increase the debt limit because you can actually service that limit. Is the same, you know, is your spending caps the same as like 10 years ago? Hopefully not, right? Hopefully you have like a bigger budget to spend on things. And I think that's the way to look at it. So I don't think it's really like a big thing that's really influencing the markets.
So you're talking about like you want top line growth to outrun debt growth essentially, right? Like you want to see that upside, you know, within the bigger economy.
Yeah, I think the US economy is growing, right? The numbers are very strong. You know, people really have tried to talk down the economy this year, you know, because last year the US stocks went down, but we haven't really seen a back-to-back negative years since like 20 years. And before that, it was like 50 years ago. So it's really uncommon. And I think the other more important factor is that end of last year, inflation in the US was like 8-9%. Mm. And, you know, our view based on data, not on sentiments or feeling, like a lot of people like argue, you know, all the hell long about, well, you know, based on data, then inflation would drop really to like 3% this year. And this is going to set off, you know, a huge rally in risk assets, you know, meaning tech stocks, meaning crypto, because there's going to be less pressure of the US hiking interest rates. And we're having the FOMC, the Fed meeting in 2 weeks' time. They are expected now to pause. And of course, they're trying to say, well, we're pausing now and we're monitoring, but we're going to start hiking again. I think they're just, you know, pushing a little bit like a hawkish narrative that they keep on hiking. But I think they're done. I think inflation is actually now falling below the interest rate level. And this is something that we rarely see, right? So interest rates in the US are 5.25% right now. Versus the year-on-year change in inflation is now below 5%. So you can argue that the Fed has caught up with the inflation number, but now they are behind it. And if they're behind it, they need to think a little bit, well, the economy can also have like lower interest rates, and this is when they can actually cut at one point. And I think the market is kind of positioning itself for it in front rank. And this is why we suddenly have these stories emerging about, you know, ChatGPT and AI. I mean, we didn't have this last year, right? Because last year it was all negative, but this year it's positive, right?
I mean, just look at Nvidia and Palantir and but anyway, sorry, cut you off.
Yeah, no, I think that's kind of these stories are emerging in the bull market and not in the bear market. And I think, you know, reading the signs, of course, there's like some, you know, little fatigue in the crypto market, you know, the last week or two or three. But Bitcoin is up, you know, more than 60% year to date. So you cannot really complain too much. You know, it's really going, you know, the right direction.
How do you see the crypto verse, the crypto industry reacting to the tightening of conditions? I mean, what does the debt deal mean for Bitcoin and other digital assets?
Yeah, I don't think it's a big impact. Mm-hmm. Right?
I love that. Because everybody like to associate like some news with some sort of like a causation or even a correlation, right? And sometimes they're just not in the same, they're just not important.
Well, again, I mean, it's a little bit, you know, my style, and you know, this is like the style I kind of had from, you know, from my previous, you know, hedge fund roles. Yeah. Where you're just trying to make sense when prices move. You know, what was kind of the trigger? Was it really this event, or was it something else that happened actually a week later or something, and it was maybe priced in? And I kind of took the same approach, really just writing this book is the same approach, right? And also here, when actually have, you know, Bitcoin prices rallied, let's say since December. And what I discovered is every time when the US inflation data is being released, which is usually between the 10th to the 12th of every month, you suddenly had like a big rally in the price of Bitcoin. You know, the biggest one was, of course, in December, it had like a 7% move. And then you had like something like a 4% move the following months and so on. But the last 2 months, it wasn't really that impactful anymore. Yes, inflation data came in lower, but you can argue maybe it's like priced in. Maybe kind of people know this. It's really some people on TV talking, oh, inflation is going to be sticky and it's going to be really bad. And then, oh yeah, it came in lower. But you know, so I mean, this is like really like the trend. And then I try to like point out then, you know, around like May, kind of, I think May 13, 14 or something, like after the data came out, that, well, it was a little bit disappointing. So maybe the market needs a little bit more for like a push higher. So inflation or slash macro is not going to be the big driver anymore, because this was our like big story. And this is why we were very vocal in December and said like, we're going to have a big rally because of this inflation comes lower. But there's nothing really on the horizon that's really driving the Bitcoin price right now, you know, like ordinals or meme coins or something. It's not like strong enough to really lift the market higher. But it has like some impact on some specific coins and everything. So it needs a little bit more. And you know, there's this divergence happening right now, of course, between tech stock and Bitcoin. And they used to be very correlated, because there is just more going on in terms of like stories with AI or ChatGPT or NVIDIA or something. So crypto needs a little bit up its game
here. A bit of that. Yeah. Which is why you see a lot of, I mean, you've been very familiar kind of article that has come to my attention over the past three or four weeks would be like, you know, does crypto need AI more than AI needs crypto? And then like, you know, they're trying to fit all these AI narratives into crypto, right? And I think it's just trying to kind of like, you know, the industry trying to latch on to like the dominant narrative at that point in time. I mean, I just also read your recent LinkedIn post about, I think you asked AI, ChatGPT about the, it's quite interesting. Yeah. What was it again? I think you asked ChatGPT about the, for motivation, right? Is that the...
Yeah, and you know, I started to look, you know, after, because this book was like such a big project, right? So I started to look into more like, you know, ChatGPT and what you can do with it. And I didn't want to do it while I was doing the book. And actually, you know, the conclusion for these large language model, as far as I understand it. So what it does, it just takes one word after another, and then it sort of comes out with a probability. How would a human kind of finish or choose and the next word? And then it just runs these simulations like over and over and over again. And I think it's just pretty tough to do for crypto, because for crypto it doesn't really like exist, right? It's not really, you know, let's come up with some new language or new something. I mean, just because it doesn't really exist, right? And so I just kind of like just try to look around for like some themes and you know, what are kind of like, you know, ask ChatGPT, give me like 10 motivational quotes for crypto traders, right?
It's actually really interesting, because it could be applied to any other industry as well.
Yeah, but it's interesting you say this because I kind of, you know, was reading these things. I was like, oh, you probably have read this on news outlet ABC, right? This guy's like, you know, like diversify your holdings, you know, stay the course. And it's kind of interesting. It was like all these things. And I was like, wow, who came up with these things, right? And it's, it's just like interesting. So I think for crypto, it's a little bit, they're seeing this like this bullet train passing, you know, next to crypto. It's like, oh, we need to kind of jump on this train and see how we can be part of it. But, you know, I asked also some other questions, which is, what are kind of the projects to invest in or what is this? And the answer wasn't really that great. So I think it just can summarize some data, but it's not really like strong to come up with some really good cutting edge research or something like that.
I think that you made a really interesting point about how when we look at, say, the debt ceiling, right? Or rather, if you look at what happened in 2011, the debt ceiling crisis, right? I mean, I've always viewed these as just, it's just political, right? And then the idea that crypto at least needs a dominant narrative to kind of take it higher, right? And that's also why you see a lot of these commentators out there trying to kind of put one and one together, like AI and crypto.
They're commentators.
Yeah. But anyway, that's...
They're commentators. Don't listen to them.
It's not just an observer-led thing, right? I mean, it's an industry-driven narrative.
Like if you're trying to raise money for your startup right now, you just put like some sort of AI in that.
Exactly, yeah.
That, and then, you know, maybe your valuation goes up.
To put it bluntly, it's not just in crypto, right? I mean, there's like the whole ESG thing, which to me is also a very like narrative type of thing, right? There's no fundamental categorizing of all the things that are putting into ESG. Each of them are so complex, so different. Right, like how can you put them together just on the idea of like what social good, right? It's very, there is nothing tying them together from an objective measurement of how well they'll perform in a prolonged period of time, right? So it's very weird that they're put together as a theme. Mm-hmm. At least that's my spiel.
Yeah, actually on that note, because I think it was like in December or in January, I wrote a report and like saying like, oh, this is going to be a new bull market. And, you know, trying of course to just look at this inflation and, you know, expecting like a really strong, you know, I don't know, 100% or something returns this year. And, you know, we did kind of like this 66% or something so far. So we had like a strong move. And, you know, normally I think on TradFi, you would say if stocks go up like 20 or the index goes up 20%, it's a bull market. If it goes down 20%, it's a bear market. And, you know, these last few days, I started to think, well, we had a really strong rally, but it's not really like a crypto bull market per se that we're having. Because when you look back, you know, again in history, we had four, you know, really well-defined crypto bull markets. And one was payment, you know, the new payment method in 2011, then 2013, kind of new form of money and with China. And 2017, we had, of course, the ICO. And then 2021, we had, of course, the yield farming, you know, craze and everything. So we don't have anything right now, right? I mean, the ordinals definitely doesn't qualify for it.
We have the frog, though.
There was the frog.
Pepe and also what? Turbo.
Pepe is the new lord, right?
I completely agree.
I would argue we need to keep on looking, right? And again, you know, I think if you look back at some of these historical events, like, you know, the market has completely changed over the last 3 years and this whole, you know, crypto bull market of 2021, it just like went out of it went from nowhere and it moved so quickly within literally like a quarter or two, right? So you need to really have, you know, your hand at the pulse and really like kind of feel it. And I think that's really like important, but we don't have anything right now. So that's why we need to keep on looking. And that's why I think actually maybe we cannot really call this right now a bull market. Even we are up, you know, 50% this year.
Although I would argue maybe the 2021 one, it feels as if that one is really in large part driven by, you know, the macro environment. You know, like you have that unprecedented...
Yeah, it wasn't just crypto. Yeah,
yeah, quantitative easing. So like as compared to the previous few cycles. But I feel like there was a bit more of like a... I don't want to say fundamental, but it feels as if it felt a bit more substantial in the way that the narratives were being built up.
Yeah, because you had like treasury departments, right? You know, Tesla bought. You had MicroStrategy, of course, bought. You know, you got big hedge fund managers like Paul Tudor Jones suddenly saying, you know, Bitcoin is like the fastest horse in an inflation rally. And it legitimized for a lot of, you know, TradFi people to buy it and everything. So yeah, of course, all the bull markets are different, but there will be a new one, I'm very sure, because there's like so many people still involved and so much VC money. You know, $60 billion of VC money has gone into crypto the last 2 years.
Right? Wow.
So,
I mean, VC need to make back that money.
At least for this is like, I guess, you know, it's not an original perspective. Like, we're just essentially repeating what people have been repeating about Bitcoin since like time immemorial.
Let's hear it.
Right, is that the world essentially wants an alternative to, you know, like just your traditional banking systems, you know, and like payment systems, right? And then right now Bitcoin kind of represents that. This is what I think is where people who view the optimism in the space, right, it's what they're trying to build, what they're trying to work towards. So as long as that kind of holds true and like, you know, there isn't something else that comes in to kind of take that place, you know, and there's equal part like a technology thing, but also like a branding, marketing, and narrative aspect to it, you know, that comes together, right? So that's maybe like the next bull cycle can help bring us closer to that point. That would be.
I think that's a fundamental problem. It's not so much a narrative problem. You really got to solve adoption. You got to solve cost of, you know, it's a very technical.
No, I'm not just saying it's an optics or PR thing. What I'm trying to say is that the idea that, you know, why people hold Bitcoin right now, right?
Make money, that's it. I don't think people are apocalyptic, you know. Yes.
But we're not due another bull market yet, right? I mean, you say it's every 3 years.
Well, again, I think it's difficult to... I don't think we're in a bull market right now. I think this has been just like a macro liquidity, lower inflation story. And there needs to be something else. There needs to be something more, right? Mm-hmm. Because I'm also just not happy about this whole, that everybody's like so hyped up about this whole staking episode, right? Because staking, what does it mean? You just put your asset to something and get like a, you know, some like fixed income return. I mean, that is not really sexy, right? That's not really, you know, where people need to be like smart and move the money around. I mean, at least with the yield farming craze, there was like all these projects that were like, you know, trying to attract capital funding and tokens and everything. And you need to, you know, be ahead of the curve. You need to kind of judge, okay, who's going to follow and who, you know, where can I move from here, take the yield 2-3 days later, go somewhere else and just move the money quickly around. Here it's like, well, you put it in Ethereum and you just sort of like wait every year, you're getting like 4%. And I mean, it's just like, you know, that is not really why people are in crypto, right?
Yeah, so why are you here? 4%.
Yeah,
many 4%. Places can get you 4%. Yeah.
So, well, you know, as you know, like Nvidia, right, it was up like 25% overnight when they released earnings, right? So I think it's a little bit difficult. I think there needs to be something more. And it's really like an outcry for the industry to improve, develop something.
Improve. Give me something.
Exactly. Something.
Right. Solana phone. That's going to be the
fuck. Solana phone. Solana phone.
Yeah.
Okay, we don't go there. But
let's not go there. Okay.
But yes, great. So we went on a whole spiel around how the US debt ceiling is not important, right? It's not going to affect crypto cycles. So it is what it is. Yeah. So let's bring us to the third story.
Right.
Bro.
For our third story, we're going to be looking at the upcoming crypto regulations in Hong Kong. So on the 1st of June, Hong Kong is going to welcome with open arms. Which is today, right?
It is today. That's
today. Oh my god! Yeah. Right. So they're gonna
flying?
Welcome. I'm not flying there, dude.
Boss, why are you not flying us?
Huh?
We should all be flying there now.
Sure. So,
you can still go.
It's 5 hours. Yeah, we have time.
Can get there by like, you know, like dinner. Yeah. Airport, so. Okay. Straight away go and buy some like.
Yeah, you see our producer very high on the side. It's like, yeah, Hong Kong.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, the move here is that, you know, like they're gonna welcome retail and institutional crypto investors into Hong Kong. It's interesting because, you know, Hong Kong was a crypto hub until China's 2021 ban. So I mean, you could argue there's some mixed signals, but like, you know, I mean, ultimately, it could very well be a geopolitical thing as well. You see the US being harsher on crypto companies and then like the East kind of opening up, right? So other points to make here would be you have China-founded crypto exchange, Huobi, is one of the exchanges that has taken up the offer. So it's officially applied for a Hong Kong Securities Regulatory Commission.
I thought it's called Huobi. Huobi, yes.
Huobi, sorry.
You are a Chinese person.
That's right.
Sorry, please continue.
My pronunciation is
me. Yeah. It's fine. It's Huobi, okay, guys? It's Huobi Wang.
Right. And yeah, so Gate.io and have also BitMEX have announced their applications. And while OKX and ZA Bank have signaled their intentions to apply for a VASP license. So bring the floor to the team. I know, Marcus, you've based yourself in Hong Kong for a while, right? I was wondering whether you have any thoughts on...
Yeah, I think crypto adoption in Hong Kong has been, of course, extremely rapid. And it really set the level playing field from the regulator, from the HKMA, the Hong Kong Monetary Authority, back in 2014, you know, where we had, of course, a lot of, you know, crypto exchanges being set up there. Also, Bitcoin ATMs were set up. And I think we're seeing something a little bit similar. But I think this time the HKMA is working very closely with the SFC, so the Securities and Futures regulator there. So, and I think it's a good step in the right direction.
I guess looking at the history, right, with China's just stance on crypto, and then now we're seeing this in Hong Kong, right? Like, I mean, the obvious thing to me is just to really look at what's happening in the world and especially in the US, and then come to a conclusion there as to why that's happening. But I was wondering whether you have a view on that.
So one thing that's very important, of course, for the industry to move forward and really bring in a lot more capital is really to provide the level playing field for institutional investors. And of course, that's why, you know, these big financial hubs, let's say like New York or London or Hong Kong, are like extremely important. And I think with Hong Kong appearing to really take the lead in this right now, providing the level playing field, you know,
what
making
is
it
level
easier.
Level playing field?
Well, that, you know, because right now, for example, what is a security, right? Those things are not really like solved in the US, you know, apparently. How much crypto can you actually hold as a fund? Can you be licensed? A lot of investors, they need to engage with a licensed entity. And for example, if you set up a regulated licensed fund under the SFC in Hong Kong, you might not be able to trade with unlicensed exchanges like Binance. So you have to trade, let's say, with OSL. And we know OSL has working very closely with Interactive Brokers, you know, opening that door. And the more exchanges and the more firms that can be licensed, the more asset managers might be licensed. And the more this ecosystem sets up the level playing field for those institutions. And I think, for example, London is working on something similar. So the largest clearer where all the trades being cleared, the separate entity is called LCH for TradFi. They're also working on clearing for crypto firms. So, you know, no longer need to, you know, have it all on one exchange and everything. And I think this is the level playing field that those people are working in the background. And of course, you don't see this in the prices every day, but stuff is being done. And I think Hong Kong has been proactively on this and having really like an open door policy for those institutions, you know, to come in and listening to them. There have been a lot of consultation being done. And again, I think taking the example, you know, from and the timing from Justin Sun, I mean, he has voiced very often that Hong Kong is going to be sort of like the stage for China to eventually open it more, you know, to the mainland. And I think based on his track record and how often he has been, you know, really his timing has proven like so right, you know, we need to be, I think, listen to it a little bit more careful what he says.
Timing, huh? It's all about timing.
It's all about Justin Sun.
I'm also just, you know, just so curious, you know, about what would be some of the, I guess, the implications, right? Like, I guess you would probably see more liquidity coming in from the mainland to Hong Kong now that this has happened. That's one. And then
I think that was something that we were talking about like 2 weeks ago or was it last week?
Yeah.
We're talking about
we see like a pump in Chinese tokens, coins, you know, I think that's the two.
Yeah. So I think there were two questions that were running around. One, are we going to see like mainland liquidity move in or are we going to see liquidity move into mainland through Hong Kong? Yeah. Any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, right now, there's, of course, you know, the usage of VPNs in China,
of course,
with crypto.
Not right now. It's been around for a long time.
Yeah, not right now. But it's, of course, I mean, just what's currently going on, right? And of course, a lot of the trades happen also on OTC platforms. And this is also something that has started. Mm-hmm. But very similarly as in 2014, a lot of the liquidity from China came to Hong Kong. And again, a lot of people are not aware of, but there was a moment in time in 2013 where 90% of all the Bitcoin trading was happening in China. So there is a lot of money, a lot of liquidity, a lot of volume there. And then actually 2014, the most important crypto market became suddenly Hong Kong. So I wouldn't really rule out, you know, for some people, maybe Hong Kong might be like a small city and everything now, but I wouldn't rule out that Hong Kong might be, could become like really big too. So I think we should definitely have it on our radar and really follow very closely what's happening there, because I think the world is really looking for a place that is really like a leading financial city and can provide the level playing field.
Actually,
again,
from a retail investor point of view, like, why is Hong Kong, like, why should I care about Hong Kong then? And based on what you've just lined up, right? Like, provide a level playing field, blah, blah, blah. That's like for insti guys, right? But for like the men on the street listening in, you know, the crypto enthusiasts, they make money, they're retail investors. Why should I care about Hong Kong?
Well, you know, very simple. I mean, Hong Kong has like 8 million people, right? They're not going to move the needle. Even they have been, you know, in the past, you know, being quite, let's say, aggressive in trading volatile products, you know, warrants or form of option and structured products have been, of course, you know, very popular there, and yield products and everything. But I think for anybody in the world, basically, if you can deal and trade through a regulated financial institutions, it's probably worth more than trading through an unregulated. And I think that is just because it gives you like a another level of comfort. You know, the regulator, you know, there needs to be some capital requirements. You know, I think one of the best examples is actually, and again, a lot of people just don't know this, and I didn't have much, you know, knowledge about this before, but actually Japan has put together a really nice level playing field where exchanges need to have a lot of capital set aside. You know, the assets need to be to like say 95% in cold storage and everything. And that's why the customers of FTX in Japan are actually all fine. So that's actually very interesting, because the level playing field has been set there because the regulator has set clear guidelines for exchanges. And because FTX wanted to deal with, you know, locally with clients and with retail investors, the regulator sets the bar really high. And this is why there's been like no assets lost there really on this platform. And I think if Hong Kong provides like a level playing field like this, and one of these larger exchanges kind of agrees to these terms and really wants to do business, then the money can flow from like other countries to these places as well.
That's a good point.
That's a good point. Yeah, I mean, like between Singapore, you know, Hong Kong, Japan, it feels like a round robin. You know,
really? You think Singapore is going to be something here?
No, I don't think so. Not anymore.
What about your hot take? That's just your hot take on Singapore?
No, at least not at the moment. Maybe we can, as
Hong Kong, you know, continues to grow in this space, what's your hot take about the ecosystem in Singapore?
Well, I think Singapore is very well positioned towards, you know, attracting VC, venture capital money, dealing with, you know, the ecosystem that's growing in Indonesia, in the Philippines, and in Vietnam, you know, providing really, being the capital provider for those regions. And I think those regions are actually very important also to building various parts of the ecosystem. So the exchange system actually might really develop in Hong Kong, and the asset management business maybe might also develop in Hong Kong like faster. But I think Singapore seems to have, you know, really a strong foothold in providing VC, crypto VC capital for the likes of Vietnam that are building a lot of the projects, again, for maybe consumers in the Philippines, and really ties in those markets quite well.
Because all the investors want to know that you have a vehicle in Singapore.
That's the market, true.
Right? Yeah, like, for sure. Like you want to invest in Indonesia? Okay, you pitch to me. Okay, so where's your investment vehicle? In Singapore? Okay, I put my money. Right. So that's the thing about the region, yeah, in general. So that means there's not much crypto innovation. Yeah, it's just a VC play.
Just a sugar daddy.
Yeah, just sugar daddy. Sugar daddy. Which is not a bad business. Yeah. Just saying, right? Yeah, so it is what it is.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool, yeah. And so that's it for another episode of Blogcast. We'll see you all next week. And so if you want to read all the leading articles, head over to blockhead.co. Okay.
Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks.
Now I never send invoice, so don't worry. Okay, so see you guys.
Thanks.
Bye.
See you. Bye.
Hey Coconuts, so yes, I hope you enjoy this new show that we're building together with the team at Blockhead. And the goal is very clear, right? We're not here to shield any token or be a cheerleader for any project, but we feel that there's a lot of development that's going on in this space that we could cover and continue to be a little bit smarter as investors. I mean, eventually you tune in every week to a financial podcast network so that you can be smarter with your investments. And if so happen, this is something that you're looking at, the crypto space, Web3, Metaverse, all these kind of stuff, then that is where we're trying to cover, but not from the angle of like, this is good, that is bad, but really trying to see it from like, what is happening? How is it developing? And I hope you find this useful and interesting, right? So if you want to continue to get more coverage around the crypto space, check out blockhead.co. And then we will see you next week.